If you cut massively the taxes that corporations pay, then the amount of money coming into the Washington is going to go down. This is not rocket science. You're going to be hearing endlessly about how there isn't money for student loans, for fixing the highways, for colleges, for your medical care, for your Social Security and your Medicare and your Medicaid. You're going to hear it forever. There's not enough money. And you know something? This is right. But there's a reason there's not enough money, because you just cut the taxes on the corporations.
That's Richard Wolff, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Wolff on cutting corporate taxes. Corporations are riding high in the saddle. With their friends in Washington, they are raking it in. That certainly is the case with the tax law passed by Congress in late 2017. If you look at the details, it's nothing more than warmed-over trickle-down economics. While most workers will get crumbs, the big winners will be corporations. And along the way, the deficit will go way up. Corporate tax contributions to the federal budget has been declining for decades, and this bill will make it worse. The right-wing plan seems clear. Cut taxes on corporations and then reduce and eliminate programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps because there's no money. As the saying goes, the rich have gotten richer and the poor poorer. Inequality has soared into the stratosphere. To bring it down, we need a concerted grassroots movement. Our guest today is Richard Wolff. He's professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. The New York Times calls him America's most prominent Marxist economist. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy at Work. He spoke at Judson Memorial Church in New York. And now, Richard Wolff.
Some of you may have seen the announcement of a new automobile plant being built in Montgomery, Alabama. It is a joint product, a factory being built by Toyota and Mazda, two Japanese car companies. And it will provide, they say, 4,000 jobs for auto workers when it's done. It's going to take probably 2 or 3 years, maybe a bit longer, to do that. And so the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, and several others were there. Mr. Trump made a few remarks from Washington, since, of course, this is good PR for him. There are jobs being created here in the United States, which he has promised to do. If you look at the overall statistics of job creation in the United States, it's very little. So he needs desperately to make a mountain out of these events. So let's take him, give him credit where it's due. He may have had something to do with it. It's hard to know. Toyota and Mazda didn't indicate anything that he had done, but there was an effort to bring them. And I want to tell you a little bit about that. So first, the state of Alabama offered an incentive package, that's their word, an incentive package of $370 million in tax abatements and investment rebates. I have no idea what the phrase investment rebate means, but my guess is it's the effort of a PR person in the governor's office not to have to say, we gave them a lot of money, but that's what it is. And that's not all, that's the state. In the release, and I'm looking here at ABC News' release, the $370 million figure does not include a local incentive package. I guess that's Montgomery, Alabama, the city. And the state will also provide workforce training, whatever that exactly means. So I'm going to round up the $370 million and say there's another $30 million of local support and training. It's probably a conservative estimate. It may be well above that. But let's say roughly $400 million. Okay. The entire project of building and operating this thing is a $1.6 billion operation. So you just gave them a 25%, one quarter of that, discount. It works out to $100,000 per worker. Now, it's really important for everyone to understand that if the state of Alabama, which is one of the poorer states in the United States, right down there in the, you know, the bottom 10, $400 million. Try to imagine what you could do to the schools in Alabama, to the roads in Alabama, to you name it in Alabama, if you had $400 million. How many people's lives you could transform? And not just now, but for the future, say, through health care or education or the long-term things that make a society work. You didn't do that. You gave $400 million to two of the biggest, richest automobile companies on the face of this earth. Where is it decided? How is it decided that this is the best you can do with your $400 million? Well, it's good for a photo op. It makes the governor look like, oh, I'm bringing jobs to Alabama, especially if no one asks the question, gee, what might you have done with $400 million? How many people's jobs might you have created by having a proper daycare program in your state? It has none. By having a program for elderly, a problem in the whole United States about which relatively nothing is being done, and on and on and on. In terms of the service it provides, in terms of the jobs it creates. No conversation, ever. We are to look at this as if it were kind of an isolated event, as if we're, our job is to say, gee, 4,000 jobs is better than zero jobs, which it clearly is. But that oughtn't to be the way this is done. And imagine if what we did is we said we're going to create hundreds of worker co-ops in Alabama. And we're going to provide a fund, a $400 million fund, to allow the state of Alabama to say to groups of working people that are ready to produce something useful, are ready to go to work, just need the capital with which to get a business going. Maybe a business that used to be run by Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who built it up over 40 years and who are now 65 years of age and they want to retire. And their children are not interested in running this business. Their children are doing something else. And they face a very crisis situation. What are they going to do if they're going to retire? They could shut the place down. That deprives the 212 workers who have given their lives to this place of a job. It deprives the local community of all the revenue that a functioning factory or office or store provides. They don't want to destroy the community. They grew up there. And they don't want to screw all those people. They hired them. But what are they going to do? If they sell it to another company, who knows what that company is going to do? They don't want to shut it down. They don't want to sell it to another. What can they do? Oh, there is something they can do that would keep the jobs there and would keep the community going. They could sell it to their own workers who would run it as a co-op. All over the United States, people are doing that. Many more are trying to do it than can do it. And one of the things that's holding back people from doing this is the money. Guess what you might have been able to do with $400 million to say to the people of Alabama, and now multiply it by 50 states in this country, to all the people across the country, say, here's the money, let's see what you can do. And in case you thought I just invented this idea, I didn't. The British Labour Party, that's the sort of the number two political party in Britain, in England, which is currently winning all the polls. I mean, if things continue the way they are now, that will be the next government of Great Britain. And it's run by a guy named Jeremy Corbyn. He's the chief of that political party. And he's kind of an older white guy, reminds you a little bit of Bernie Sanders, sort of the British version. And here's one of his policies. They're going to, he says, if we win the next election, which, as I say, they're now currently slated to do, if we win the next election, we're going to pass two laws right away. Law number one is going to be called a law for the right of first refusal. What does that mean? It means that every business in England that wants to continue in the way it is, you're free to go. Do it. But any business that decides either it's going to close or it's going to sell itself to some other business or it's going to go public, issue shares and become a stockholder company or leave Britain and relocate somewhere else, any company wants to do any of those things has to first, here we go, give its own workers the right of first refusal, meaning before it can do any of those other things, it has to offer their own workers the option of buying the enterprise and running it as a co-op. I told you there are two laws. That was the first one. What's the second one? Is to establish a huge national fund to lend those workers the money they need to do it. In other words, they're doing what Alabama could have. But if you take the time and trouble, which I did, to look at the Alabama major newspapers, here's the news. Not one paper, not one journalist, and no politician of either party had the slightest idea to do what I just described to you. It's a wonderful example that if you don't want to know what's going on, you won't. You will become self-determinately and very effectively ignorant. You will celebrate what they're doing here because you have closed off any awareness of what the alternatives are among which you actually could choose. Next short item. There's a great deal of talk about the impending arrival of self-driving automobiles, self-driving trucks, self-driving vehicles in general. And estimates have been made that say, for example, here in the United States, 4 million people will lose their jobs. You may be interested to know little statistics. That's what a lot of us in economics do. And if you're not good at it, that's all you do. You just look up numbers and you write them down and you send emails to other people who are doing the same thing and they send you emails and then you go to sleep. In 29 U.S. states, truck driving is the most popular profession. That is, more people are driving trucks than any other line of work. 29 states. That's more than half of the United States. Truck driving is the number one in terms of the number of people that whose livelihood depends on that. So you're talking about a spectacular loss of jobs. So I picked up a story, how they are dealing with this in Scandinavia, particularly in Sweden. I was struck by the simple way they explained their strategy, so I thought I would present it to you. They were asked, what are you going to do about it? And the answer there of the Swedish Minister for Employment and Integration, named Johansson. We don't protect jobs in Sweden, this person, this minister said. We protect workers. Think about that. In the United States, we think, most of us, that to protect the job and to protect the worker are the same thing. But they aren't. And they never were. What do I mean? Here in the United States, in capitalism, if you lose your job, your employer says, you know, go. I have no responsibility for you. I have no obligation to do anything. I paid you. You came. You did whatever it is we were having you do. I don't need you anymore. Have a very nice day someplace else. Sweden doesn't think like that. They feel they have an obligation. They want to protect the worker, which means they want to protect the worker from unemployment. But they don't care about protecting the job. So, for example, if technology makes a job redundant because we have the technology to drive the car without a driver, we can do it another way, well, then, good, we don't need that work done. But that has got nothing to do with the obligation to the man or the woman who made a livelihood driving the car. That we have an obligation to because that's a fellow citizen, that's a human being, that's a family, that's a community. So we will take care of that. Wow. A society committed to protecting the worker, not the job. Imagine if American workers kind of got that. Would they spend a lot of time insisting that the number of people on a team that runs a locomotive has to be 32, even though everybody knows it takes about 3? Well, we know why railroad unions do that, because they're trying to protect the job of those 32 people. And the only way you can do it in this society is to keep that job going. You have to protect the job to protect the job holder. Sweden doesn't have this problem. Of course, we will protect the job holder, but we don't have to keep a job going that makes no sense. A job that technology has rendered redundant, or a job that people don't want done anymore because they don't want to buy that stuff anymore. They've lost interest in that. So we don't need the jobs that 10,000 people did making X because the society doesn't want X anymore. Now, what do you do with those people who don't have a job anymore because that job isn't needed or wanted or is technologically obsolete? Well, here's two things a society could do, which in Sweden they discuss. So here's the two things you can do. Just think about it. How do you protect a worker without protecting his or her job? Let's take the example of the vehicles. We need X million fewer drivers. Okay, let's arrange for them to do something else that the community wants. Let's make a list of the things the community needs to rebuild our cities, to provide daycare, to have a program for the elderly, to green the American society, to make our houses be better insulated, and to make you and I, we could take these pieces of paper, instead of writing questions, write down a list of useful things that would make life in this society better. That's what those people will be asked to do. They will be paid a salary because we're going to protect them and their income and their job, but it won't be the job that we don't need anymore because that would be irrational. And we wouldn't want to be irrational, otherwise we'd have a large number of people making horse carriages. We don't need horse carriages anymore, so we don't have people doing that. And of course, the other thing that technology does is say, well, we can do with half of our workers the same amount of output it used to take twice as many because we have a new machine. What do we do in that? Well, we know what capitalists do. We know what they do. The capitalist says, wow, I can get the same number of phones or whatever we're talking about with half the number of workers because I got this machine. So I say to half the workers, you're fired. Why do I do that? Because I can sell the same number of things I made before with half the workers. So I get the same revenue, but I don't have to pay half my wage bill because I fired half of my workers. That money that I used to have to use out of my revenue to pay that half of the workers, I keep. My profits are going up with what I save from firing those workers. Of course I'm going to fire them. Why should I hire them? There's no point. It would, you'll love this now, it would be irrational. It's very important. It is irrational for capitalism. But that's because capitalism is irrational. We know what the answer is. If you can do it with half the number of workers, then you cut the working day by half. Because that way everybody has a job. But it isn't 40 hours a week, It's 20. And with 20 hours a week, you can produce the same amount of stuff with a new machine that you could before. The benefit of the technology is in the leisure of the people. That's how you use the technology. And here it has an interesting quality. The workers whose work day is cut in half, that is the majority of people. Whereas the profit goes to a minority of people. What kind of an economic system provides the benefits of technology to the minority at the expense of the majority? That's an economic system of which one could use the technical term, that sucks. That's awful. But that's what we actually have. Because we think that a job and a worker are the same thing, and that the only way to protect the worker is to protect that particular job that they were doing, which has never been true, ever, ever, ever. But you have to think about the alternative, otherwise you think you have to do the irrational, because in this crazy society, it makes sense. Example, China. And by the way, when I give examples from China, I do it with a tongue-in-cheek. This is not an attempt on my part to suggest that China is heaven and all that. China has lots of problems, but they're different from the problems we have. And in that difference, lots of lessons can be learned. All right. China is already a larger market for electric vehicles that are not run by fossil fuel, that are run by electricity, than either the United States or Europe. In other words, if you're interested in electric vehicles, the Chinese are already ahead of us. The Chinese banned 553 models of passenger cars because they burn too much fossil fuel. They're only going to allow companies, both Chinese and foreign, to produce fossil fuel cars if they burn at a low level and do not pollute the air. Why can they do that? Aren't they worried about the profits of these companies? And their answer is, we're not going to allow the air. By the way, China has had terrible air problems for years. Their industrialization has been very fast, and it has produced terrible pollution. Some of the worst pollution in the world is in major Chinese cities. Again, they've had their problem, but they are reacting to these problems. And so they've made the decision, we're not going to allow that. And if there's a problem, if there are jobs that are lost in those places that can't make these gas guzzler cars, we will find other work for those folks to do. That's it. We will protect them, the worker, but not the job. We're not going to protect the job of a polluting car. We're not going to do it. They're thinking like the Swedish. Global CEO pay. The Bloomberg News Service provides a chart, and it's a chart that shows the relationship between what CEOs get and the average income of workers in the companies of which these folks are CEO. And it's a comparison across 22 countries. Okay. And I want you to be proud, because the United States ranks number one. The CEO pay relative to the average worker, United States, is 265. That is, the CEO, on average, gets 265 times what the average worker gets. And I thought you might like to know some of the other countries where they rank. The number two country, second only to the United States in the inequality between the top of the pyramid economically and the average, is India. India, 229. The United States, 265 to 1. India, 229. India, one of the poorest countries on this planet. One of the biggest countries on this planet. The second big giant of Asia after China, has a level of inequality second only to the United States. Number three, the United Kingdom, 201. Number four, the Republic of South Africa, 180 to 1, a level of inequality ranking number four in the world. Number 5, Netherlands. Number 6, Switzerland. Number 7, Canada. Number 8, Spain. Number 9, Germany. Number 10, China. China, the ratio is 127 to 1. United States, 265 to 1. Inequality in the United States, way bigger than the People's Republic of China. Okay, let me turn then to the major topic, which is the plan, the GOP-Trump plan. I now call it the GOP-Trump economic plan or the GOP-Trump tax plan. Originally, I would have called it the Trump plan, but the differences between the Trump and the GOP have been ironed out, which is a polite way of saying the GOP has fallen in line behind Mr. Trump, and whatever earlier hesitations they might have had, they have thrown caution to the winds, and they are now 100% behind him. You could see that in what happened to Mr. Bannon, and you can see it in lots of other places. So let's review what has happened. Basically, throughout the first year of Mr. Trump's government, he tried to get two basic changes made, his priorities. The first was to repeal the Obama health care, the Affordable Care Act, and the second one was to get a tax reform through. He failed on the first one. He couldn't get it. There were several Republicans, if you remember, voted against, and it could not get through. So he failed on that one, and that left him with the tax in the second half of 2017. And there he succeeded. The Republicans lined up 100% behind him. The very same Republicans who weren't willing to go with him on the Affordable Care Act repeal did go with him on the taxes. Collins, McCain, those some of you who follow these things. And what did this tax do? The actual document, it's two volumes that are, you know, each 3 or 4 inches thick, so you can't possibly talk about it all. That's what made Washington journalists have a wonderful time when they discovered that the people who voted on this, the senators and the congressmen, had about 3 weeks or less to read these two things, which, of course, they didn't do. And their staffs didn't do it either. The reading is about as exciting as working your way through the telephone book here in New York. I mean, even if you know about these things, it's, nobody in their right mind would do this. Only a lobbyist whose job it is on page 284 to change the verb in a particular paragraph because it'll make $50 million more dollars for the company that they represent, they write the stuff.
You're listening to Richard Wolff on Cutting Corporate Taxes. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So what did this tax bill do? Well, you don't need all of it. I can save you the time. The single biggest thing it does, what you know about, is to reduce corporate profits tax. In the United States, you have to pay a tax on your income. You all know that. If you make income, personal income, you have to pay a tax on your income. You're allowed to deduct certain expenses, and then the difference between your income and the allowable deducted expenses is what you have to then look up on that table and pay the tax. Corporations are also required to pay a tax on their profits. They take their revenues, whatever they sell, they subtract the expenses they incur to produce what they sell, and that difference, the profits, are subject to a tax. The nominal rate for corporations was 35%. In other words, they were required a flat rate of 35% on their profits. They were allowed deductions and exemptions of all kinds, which were written into the law over the last 100 years by their lobbyists. They pay people, that's what a lobbyist is, a company or an industry pays people to spend all day, every day in Washington, D.C. Their job is to flood the offices of the appropriate senators and representatives with information about why the right thing to do is X, Y, and Z. If these arguments aren't enough, then they take them out to very good French restaurants in Washington and they buy them dinner. if that isn't enough, and at this point I have to stop, but you all know exactly where I could go, because you all know. It's that wonderful Leonard Cohen song, right? Title of the song, Everybody Knows. Everybody Knows. That's what lobbyists do. They get the law to be written to give them exemptions and deductions. So when we as economists, we look at their profits and we deduct what you can, we see what they've done, we can go and look at it. The actual rate paid by American corporations on average was about 24-25%. They got the 35 down to 24-25%. And what's interesting about that is that's kind of what it is in most countries that are industrial developed countries, Western Europe and Japan and so on. So the argument, the United States has the highest tax, 35%, is technically true, but is, to use a subtle term, a lie, because it isn't what anybody pays. In economics, we teach students the difference between the nominal rate of tax, 35%, and the effective rate of tax. It's in the textbook, every textbook, which is then conveniently forgotten by the politician who wants you to believe we're reducing it. So what did the law do? It reduced the nominal rate from 35% to 21%. That's a cut of about 40%. You with me? You cut the tax on corporate profits by roughly almost a half. That is staggering. That never happens. But what makes it really interesting is the following. The last 30 years have been record years of corporate profits. They don't need this. They've been roaring the last 30 or 40 years. But it gets better. 100 years ago, corporate tax was a major part of the tax revenue of the United States government. Over the last 100 years, particularly since World War II, we've shifted the tax off of corporations onto individuals. Let me just give you one statistic, the one I like best. 1945 to 50. For every dollar Washington got by taxing individuals, you and me, it got a dollar and a half taxing corporations. In other words, the corporations as a whole paid 50% more to fund Washington than we as individuals did. Last year, the same numbers, for every dollar taxed out of American individuals, corporations paid 25 cents. In other words, over the last period since the Second World War, roughly half a century, the burden of taxation has been shifted off of business onto individuals. That's why we've had a tax revolt of individuals. It's not because our taxes went up in the sense of an absolute rise. It was the tax burden was shifted from business to you. It was also shifted from the high income earners to everybody else. For example, in the 1950s and 60s, the top rate of the individual income tax, you ready? 91%. In 1944, during World War II, it was 94%. You know what that means? For every dollar a rich person earned, over 25 grand a year in 1944, this was the law. That rich person had to give 94 cents to Washington, and he or she got to keep a nickel and a penny. That's what they got. Nobody said boo. Roosevelt signed the bill, the Republicans and the Democrats passed it. And Roosevelt gave a speech saying, if we're asking our young men and women to fight a war in World War II, the least we can do is have everybody pay according to their ability. And if you're a rich person and you earn over $25,000, by the way, if you adjust for inflation, that'd be about $400,000 a year now. So rich people had to pay their share, had to kick in. Thanks. What is it today? The top rate? 30-something percent, depending on how you count. So the rich people went from 91 to 30, and the corporations got rid of the taxes and put it. That's why you are all paying taxes up the wazoo. Because you pay what the corporations don't, and you pay what the wealthy don't. It's staggering. At this point in this country's history, to give corporations a 40% cut, it is so weird, so obscene, so crazy, that there is no conceivable way to justify it in terms of what has happened to us, what has happened, as I've just summarized for you, in our history. So the rationale given by the Republicans and Mr. Trump is completely different. They can't discuss why this is reasonable given the history. I just gave you the history. It's crazy. So instead, the argument is about, and you're going to love this, the future. Here's how it works. By giving the cut to the business, they're going to save a ton of money, correct, that they don't have to pay Uncle Sam in taxes. Because it went down by 40% from 35 to 21. And here comes the really good stuff. And this is great for all of us. It is? Yes. They're going to use the money that they don't give to Uncle Sam to create jobs, to expand the economy. You know what we used to call this? Trickle-down economics. The old idea, you give to the people at the top, and the benefits trickle down to the rest of us. That's what this is. It's a promise about the future. Mr. Trump and the Republicans know what the future is. I thought only those ladies in the carnival know that sort of thing. But they do. Now, let's be sure you understand the economics. If a corporation saves 40% of its profits tax, it doesn't have to pay to Washington anymore, what is the corporation going to do with that money? First, the decision is made by the board of directors. That's 15 to 20 people. General Motors has 150,000 employees. They have absolutely no say about this. The 15 people on the board of directors, they decide, what do we do with the money that we don't have to give Uncle Sam in taxes anymore? Option number one, they can give it to themselves. They can boost their salaries. They can have a bonus or six. They can have a larger office, a fleet of airplanes. They can do anything they want. You know why? Because we live in a free enterprise system. They're free. They're free to do whatever they want. Number two, to keep their shareholders quiet, they can take a portion of the money they don't pay in taxes to the government and increase the dividends they pay to shareholders. Third thing, they can create jobs, maybe. In India or Brazil, they can do that wherever they want. Why? Because they're a free enterprise. The idea that they're going to take that money and use it to create jobs here in the United States, besides being a prediction of the future, which is an amazing thing to be able to do, violates every rule of economics we teach. They're not going to do that. And the reason we know they're not going to do it is because they haven't been doing it. And they haven't been doing it because they can't sell crap in this country anymore because the American people don't earn enough. And the American people are up to here with debts that they've accumulated the last 20 years, and they can't borrow much more. So there's no point in producing more here in the United States. And even if there were, it's more profitable to produce it someplace else anyway. So we're being told this is a great thing because, listen to Mr. Ryan from Wisconsin. I mean, I don't advise that as a matter of health. It'll get your blood pressure boiling. But this man, unlike all the rest of us, knows what's going to happen in the future, just like Mr. Trump, his boss. So they've done it. Now let's finish the story. How are they going to deal with this? If you cut massively the taxes that corporations pay, then the amount of money coming into Washington is going to go down. This is not rocket science. That leaves the government in Washington with two options. Option number one, and this is what we're going to come to, stop doing a lot of the things you're doing. You don't have the money anymore. You're going to be hearing endlessly about how there isn't money for student loans, for fixing the highways, for colleges, for your medical care, for your Social Security and your Medicare and your Medicaid. You're going to hear it forever. There's not enough money. And you know something? This is right. But there's a reason there's not enough money, because you just cut the taxes on the corporations. Now, suppose the Republicans, at least initially, say, that's too dangerous. We can't cut all the government services because the people will turn against us. They'll see the connection. So here's what we'll do. We'll borrow for the first year. We'll borrow the money to keep the government doing things. We'll make up with borrowing what we're not getting in the taxes from the corporation. Simple idea. What does this do? Two things. One, it increases what we call the deficit. The deficit is the difference between what the government spends and what it takes in taxes. That difference has to be borrowed. Just like if you spend more than you earn, you have to borrow the difference. The Republicans, who have said the deficit is too high, will therefore have just increased the deficit, which they said was too high. But there's method in the madness, because they'll use the higher deficit late in 2018 and right into 2019 as the argument for why we've got to cut back, our deficit is so large. If you think this is crazy, childish junk, then you've understood it. That's what this is. But the serious thing is, they're going to cut government programs, either right away or with a delay by means of this deficit. That's what this is about. This is the attempt to further gut the government, kill it off. This is a program to cut the government and to cut all the programs, all the jobs that are created in the government, all the services that you all count on, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, but all the other ones, all are being nibbled and cut and nibbled and cut. If you watch what the rest of the people in the cabinet of Mr. Trump are doing, that's what they're doing. Cutting here, cutting there, a little over here, a little over there, distracting us with you know, sending children of immigrants back to wherever the hell they came from. Separate them from their parents, and we can get all excited about the horror of all of that. But it's a distraction from what the main game here is. It's a system that is wanting to get rid of something expensive. And that expensive is a standard of living for the mass of people. The first 200 years of the United States built that standard up to be the highest in the world. That's over. And all we are now is going through the paces of taking it back down. 10 or 20% of the people in this country will be very comfortable. They're the ones doing the high-tech work. They're the ones who have the shares. They're the ones who live in the neighborhoods. You all know, because you know exactly where in New York City you want to go to see where those people live. You don't need any help from me. For the rest of us, particularly for the young people, it's over. It's over. And it's just a relentless nibbling away through all of these mechanisms to cut the standard of living, to cut the government services, to cut it, to cut it, to cut it. And the only real political question is how long the American people will tolerate this. I haven't the answer. I don't think any of you do either. Or if any of you do, please tell us. How long you can kick a population like this, how long you can deprive it. The first 10 years of the European Union, the average income in Greece doubled. Then they turned around and they savaged Greece and they took it all away again. And everybody's wondering, including the Greek people, how far can this go? Will we go back to where we were? Will we go further down? That ought to be in everyone's mind here, because that's what's happening here. The rest is the details. Mr. Trump will do it in his way, Mr. Ryan in his way, Mr. Pence in his way, and the Democrats really only will do it a little more slowly. But other than that, nothing. You can tell because they can't. I mean, the reaction of the Democratic Party to that tax bill should have been an invitation to everyone in this room and in this country, out into the street. Nothing moves as long as this. This is outrageous. Instead, they loaded. I'm against this. And then they went out for a drink. Our politics is a theater. Let's take the time we have to respond to these questions. Okay, first, in a cooperative workplace, in a worker co-op, how do you share the profits among new people versus the founders of it and maybe people with different skill levels? It's very interesting to me as I go around the country talking about worker co-ops as an alternative to a hierarchical capitalist enterprise, how well-trained Americans are, even though they don't know it. How deeply in their brains are a set of skeptical questions about this worker co-op idea. It's as if almost you've been taught to be skeptical. So let's go through it. How do you share the profits in a worker co-op among all the people there? Well, the answer is, that's for the co-op to decide. That's what a co-op means. You sit down with all the others, one person, one vote, and you decide what to do with the profits your work over the 6 months or the year has generated. Otherwise, it isn't a democratic co-op if it doesn't do that. And you know the difference in a capitalist enterprise. If you work in a capitalist enterprise, you do your job. You are paid a certain amount of money to do your job. You do the job, you get paid. At the end of the year, the company makes X profits. Your relationship to those profits is zero, nothing. You have no say over it, nothing. A board of directors, 15 people whom you do not know, who you've never met, whose names you couldn't write on a piece of paper, they decide. By the way, at the Christmas party in your business, the CEO will thank you for the year's hard work and will look at you and say, every one of you did a very important thing. You contributed to the profits of this business. Thank you. As to deciding what to do with them, go home. It's none of your business. Your job was to produce the profits. And that's when your job ends. We, a tiny group of people, you didn't elect them, you can't recall them, nothing. They decide what to do with the profits. They just thank you for helping to produce. What a system. The co-op decides collectively what to do with the profits. It could decide, this business owes a lot to Louise over there. You know why? Because Louise figured out how to make this thing we do in this factory. And we want to honor and reward her because in a way our whole business is a result of her ingenuity. And we're going to give her X dollars or X dollars every month or a house to live in or God knows what, whatever you think is appropriate. Could you give one individual that? Sure you could. Because that's what a co-op does. It decides what to do with its profits. The notion that a co-op wouldn't reward innovation? Why not? If you want to stimulate innovation, you give it a reward. Now, you wouldn't give it the kind of reward we do in capitalism. This last week, the Amazon Corporation reached a milestone. It made Mr. Jeff Bezos. It made him not only the richest man in the United States, but it made him the richest man who's ever lived in the United States. His wealth is now somewhere $110 or $112 billion. The worker co-op, unlikely to do that. Not going to give one guy $110 billion while the average worker can't send his or her kid to college. Not going to do that. Because that would be grotesque. I guess I'm saying to you, it is grotesque. How in the world do you allow this? One man with more money than God. All right. Yes. Where do you suggest workers with stagnating wages get capital without capitalists or predatory lenders? I think the answer lies in a political movement. I don't see any other way. But let me give you an example, which you all know, of a political movement that surprised everybody by generating enormous amounts of money, by getting an average, if I remember now, of $27 per donor. Bernie Sanders, 27 bucks. No big dinners for the 10,000 bucks a plate, none of that. 27 bucks. And he ended up having tens of millions of dollars to spend on making a credible campaign. Wow. So there's part of your answer. In the end, the only way that people in this country are going to change these things is if they do it. They got to get off their duff. They got to get off their hope that somebody else does it, or hope that maybe if I can just go in and vote for Joe instead of Mary or Alice instead of John, it's going to be fixed. But it's sad. There are no shortcuts here. This system has been working like this for a long time. It's got its stuff worked out really pretty well. We can beat it, but it has to be the real we. But let me give you some specific examples. And I'll use the example of a worker co-op again, because how do you get the money to start a worker co-op? Well, you may not know it, but there are in the United States banks that have lent to worker co-ops already for decades. Those banks are out there. They've done real well. That's not a problem. They're there. They're willing to lend money to workers who are going to make a worker co-op. You know why? Because they learned that when workers together make a business, they care more about it than if they just go to work for somebody else. This is not rocket science. A lot of you already believe, right, that if you own your own home, you're going to take kind of better care of it than if you're renting somebody else's building. Well, if that's true, you care more, you're more careful, you're more nurturant, you're more observant if it's yours. Well, that might apply to your business too. So maybe a worker co-op can be efficient. But here's the one I like best. Imagine you hear in your community of a business that's about to close or to move to China, and that's going to mean the end of jobs for 200 people here, 5,000 people. Some of you come from Brooklyn. You know there are several hospitals in Brooklyn that are on the edge of closing. And if they closed, tens of thousands of people are not going to have a hospital nearby, and thousands of people are going to lose their job working in these hospitals. So now suppose, you said, you know, this is a failure of the capitalist model of how to run a hospital. We're going to run it as a co-op. How about that? And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to set it up as a co-op, and then we're going to go to the local politicians, the borough president and the city council and the mayor and the governor, and we're going to all tell them the same story. Dear Mr. or Ms. Politician, here's a crisis. Tens of thousands of people are going to be without a hospital. Thousands of people are going to be without a job. We want you to help us convert this into a worker co-op so it stays there. We need to pay no taxes for 5 years. We need to get a subsidy. We need to get all. We need. And if you give that to us, Mr. Mayor, we will run around this city and we'll say you're the greatest thing that ever happened. And if you don't, you won't get elected to dog catcher ever again. You understand what I'm saying? No sweetie pie here. This is hardball. Capitalism was built in the United States on tax holidays and subsidies year in and year out for 300 years. All the worker co-ops are doing is saying, we want a little piece of that for us. And we will bury you if you don't. Which is exactly what the corporations do. That's how this game is played. But the only problem is, we're not playing. We could, we should, and eventually we will. But man, has it taken a long time before people begin to realize what's going on.
That was Richard Wolff on cutting corporate taxes. He spoke in New York. Richard Wolff, a distinguished economist, teaches at the New School in New York. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Noam Chomsky, Alfred McCoy, Glenn Greenwald, Henry Giroux, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Nancy MacLean. And we have a series of programs with Richard Wolff. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.